This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Cell Signal Solutions. Call CSS for all your in-building wireless systems. Specializing in ARCs, ERCES, and cellular DAS. Give them a call, 732-289-0388. If anyone has any questions, comments, or feedback, or would like to sponsor an episode or to support the show, please email me, sfarimchatter@gmail.com. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Sfarim Chatter podcast. On this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Eli Rubin, who is a researcher, writer, and editor at Chabad.org, and he is finishing his PhD at UCL, University College London. And we'll be discussing Rabbi Shmuel Schneerson of Lubavitch, who is the Marash, who is the fourth Rebbe, if I got that correct. And this is also relates to a recent article that he just wrote and published in the AJS Review. So thank you, Eli, for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start off. Tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background.
Okay, so I'm a Chabadnik. I grew up in the Chabad community in London. And I went through the regular yeshiva system. I learned in Manchester, in Morristown, Los Angeles, Australia. Doing Chabad tour the world. And while I was in yeshiva, I already kind of developed, a kind of historical perspective. Some of my teachers, my mashpiim in yeshiva, especially Reb Melech Subel, kind of just helped me to not only develop a greater understanding of the ideas of Chassidus, but also the historical trajectory of the context in which these ideas were developed. And so that interest kind of grew and blossomed, and I started writing and short articles. One thing led to another, and eventually I was hired to work at Chabad.org as a researcher, writer, editor. And part of my job from the outset was to, I guess, have one foot in the academic world and to read a lot of, to read whatever current research was coming out on Chabad, and to be in touch, to participate in those conversations, participate in the further development of the field, the study of Hasidism. And over the years, I've published several articles in peer-reviewed journals. I go to the Association of Jewish Studies conference every year. And this is my latest article my latest contribution to the field of the academic study of Chabad Hasidism. I have many other more popular articles on Chabad.org and classes and so on, which are kind of addressing a broader audience. But these articles are contributing original new material, new research going into the sources.
Right. So let's start off like this. Let's start off, I think, before we get to the Marash, we should probably start off give the listeners a brief overview of Chabad, Hasidus, the Rebbes, and Tillim, and after him, just, I guess, a general overview of Chabad, and then we'll go and discuss the Marash in depth.
Okay, so everyone knows about Rabbi Shnezan of Liadi, the first Rebbe of Chabad, the Baal HaTanya, and the author of the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. And one thing that people don't necessarily know that much about when it comes to the Alter Rebbe is that in addition to the Tanya, he contributed or he recited, he taught many drushim, many mamorim, which like a magid or a rabbi today, gets up and shul, something along those lines and gives a drasha. The Alter Rebbe was giving drushas, but these drushas were of a different kind of quality. And this goes back to kind of what was happening in early Hasidism. There was a new style to the drashas, which scholars have been analyzing what exactly was new, what exactly was happening, but something was happening. And people started writing down. We have many early manuscripts, and eventually these drushim, these mamorim, started to make their way into print. And for about 30 years, the Alter Rebbe said mamorim every Shabbos. And sometimes he said biurim during the week, additional explanations on the drushim that he said on Shabbos. And this is really, so Tanya is kind of a fixed text. It's a book that he wrote and published in his lifetime. And then we have hundreds of these mamorim, which were transcribed by his sons, by his Talmidim, Reb Pinchas Reisitz, his brother, Maril, And many of these Mamorim have existing manuscript in several versions, because there were different people writing them down, transcribing them. And this actually is a really important development, and it's the foundation of Chabad thought. Everything that happens afterwards, when you get to the Mitzvah Rebbe and the Samach Tzedek, the later, there's the seven Rebbes, so we're going to see that there was later a split in the movement, so they're really more than seven. But in the Chabad Lubavitch dynasty, there are seven Rebbes, and each one of them says new Mamorim, which are based on the Mamorim of the Alter Rebbe. And so there's this kind of continuous living discourse, a kind of ongoing conversation where the ideas that he expounded on and explained and developed are being reanalyzed, re-explained again in new ways, compared to each other, put it back into conversation with each other, and so on. So that's the Alter Rebbe. Then you have the Mitzvah Rebbe, his son. You want to jump in?
Let me just jump in for 1 second. Just maybe tell listeners, when Rabbi Shneur Zalman, the Alter Rebbe, like he said, the Baal Tanya, when did he live? And also, like, right. who was he a Talmud of? Where was he? Which Chassid? Maybe just right, to, right, before right. We found the Chabad. Yeah, just maybe just explain that.
Okay, so the date given is Tav Kuf Hei for his birth, which is basically the middle of the 18th century. And he passed away, actually, today, we're recording this on the evening after his Yahrzeit, Chav Dalet Teves, in 1813, so 209 years ago, he passed away. And so he lived about 70 years, covering the end of the 18th century and the first decade or so of the 19th century. He passed away during the invasion of Russia by Napoleon, really in the aftermath of that, which is a whole story in itself. And he's a student of the Magda Mezrich. After the Magda Mezrich passed away, he, in 1773, Tavkuf Lamed Gimel, he became a Talmud Chava. He was a contemporary, but also a student of Rabbi Nachum Mendel of Vitebsk, who was kind of the regional leader of the Chassidim in that area, the area where he lived, which is kind of Lita Reisen, what is called Reisen by Jews, which is like, you know, kind of the western part of Russia, some parts of Ukraine, Belarus today, and reaching into southern Russia as well. Already in his lifetime, he had Chassidim, many, many Chassidim over a large geographical area, and he became Emmanuel Eckes, the historian in Israel, has written a biography, which is also published in English by Brandeis University Press, and he describes how by the turn of the century, you know, the beginning of the 19th century, he had emerged as the most important rabbi and certainly the most important Hasidic figure in the Russian Empire. With you know, thousands and thousands of Chassidim, the Russian government put an estimate of something like 40,000 Chassidim, something like that. You know, so and he had Chassidim as far away as, you know, deep into towards Central Europe. You know, Yasti, where the Abter Rav later became Rav. So when he came, the Seif Yomov, to be Rav of Yasti, there were already Chabad Chassidim there. There was a bit of controversy over that as well. So when he passed away, his oldest son, Rabbi Doivber Shniuri, became Rabbi. There was also a split in the movement then. Rabbi Aaron of Shashela was a Talmud of the Alter Rebbe, who at one point he had been very good friends with the Mitzvah Rebbe. They were chavrusas, and they were extremely close. But later on, they had a parting of ways. Already in the lifetime of the Alter Rebbe, it seems they had a parting of ways. Difference in how they interpreted the Alter Rebbe. So something to get into for another time. Louis Jacobs wrote a book, Seeker of Unity, about Rabbi Aaron of Shashela. And but one thing, since this is the Sfarim Chatter podcast, one thing to note about the Mitzvah Rebbe was that he was a massive publisher of Sfarim. The Alter Rebbe also had published not only the Tanya and several like small kontrasim, the Siddur and Hilchos Talmud Torah was published already by the Alter Rebbe in his lifetime. The Alter Rebbe had also published the Shas and the Torah. But the Mitzvah Rebbe began a massive publication project. He was only Rebbe for 15 years. But in that time, he published the Shulchan Aruch Harav. He published new editions of Tanya. He published a siddur, what's called Siddur Imdach, which is a siddur with the Mamorim of the Alter Rebbe, which he had transcribed himself. And he curated them around the Nusach HaTfilah, printing them on the page around the Nusach HaTfilah so that you could, it was kind of a synthesis of kind of Kavonas HaRizal according to the Alter Rebbe's explanations. He writes a very interesting Hadama about his intention in creating the siddur. And he published many other Sfarim, his own Sfarim, which were Ataras Rosh and Imre Bina and so on, for all different audiences, different levels of ability to understand Chassidus, or more Musadika Sfarim, like Derech Chaim and Pekeach Ivrim. He was a very prolific writer and a very prolific publisher. And then the third Rebbe, also very famous, not just in Chabad, but in the Olam HaTorah more generally, is Samach Tzedek, who's named, known for the, by the name of his tshuvas, Samach Tzedek, but who also was the publisher of Torah Oyer and Lekutei Torah, which were compendia of the Alter Rebbe's Mamorim. So this is the first time, and after the Siddur Imdach that the Mitzvah Rebbe published, Rav Dov published, you have the Samach Tzedek publishing Torah and Lekutei Torah, which have become like the staple Sfarim. Which, if you want to learn the Alter Rebbe's Mamorim, you learn Torah and Lekutei Torah. And there's really a lot of work to be done on researching what exactly the Samach Tzedek was doing, because maybe we'll come back to this later on. But Lekutei Torah, especially, not only was he curating, choosing the Mamorim and arranging them, but he was also adding glosses, hagos, where he was contextualizing what the Alter Rebbe was saying in the whole corpus of rabbinic literature, Medr, Zoya, Shas, and different shittas in Kabbalah, and also contextualizing this maimah with another maimah. So very often I'll say, see how this is explained here, look over here, look in a different discourse. So he's like cross-referencing the Alter Rebbe and help, showing you that you need to think about, like I said before, these mamorim are in conversation with each other. And so very often, even today, you know, even people in Chabad will learn a discourse, and then they'll learn one maimer, and they'll learn another maimer, and they'll come with some kind of stira, contradiction, a kashin, and they'll be looking for terutzim. But in a way, that's the wrong way to think about these things, because it's not like a set fixed doctrine that this is how it is. It's like an ongoing flowing conversation where these things are complement each other and kind of illuminate each other in different ways. And so that's the Samach Tzedek. But the thing that's important to note, both the Samach Tzedek and the Mitzvah Rebbe are Talmidim, direct Talmidim of the Alter Rebbe. The Samach Tzedek was a grandson who was already 25 years old when the Alter Rebbe passed away. And so he knew him personally. He was learning from him. He was actually brought up by the Alter Rebbe because his mother had died when he was very young. And he was already making his own hanachas, his own transcripts of Mamorim in his teenage years. So these are both direct talmidim of the Alter Rebbe. So the first three rabbeim are almost like it's a rebbe with two talmidim, right? But then the Rebbe Marash, who's the fourth rebbe, was born after both the Alter Rebbe and the Mitzvah Rebbe had already passed away. So he's born in the 19th century. And he passes away in the 19th century. And that's really, I guess this comes to our next question. We start talking about the Rebbe Marash, the focus of this discussion.
Yeah, do you want to just, should we, I mean, it's not really pertinent to this discussion. Maybe briefly just mention, we'll leave aside the Marash for a second. Do you want to mention the Rebbe's after him? You said there were seven. Do you want to just to finish off with people? I mean, or we could just, and we'll discuss the Marash and the, what happened there?
Okay, so yeah, just quickly, there were three rabbis who came after Rebbe Marash, the Rebbe Rashab, Rishon Doiber, who was his son, his second son. He had an older son, Raza, and a younger son, Menachem Mendel, and some daughters. And then the next rabbi was Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, the Raya, it's also called the Friedrich Rebbe in Chabad. Which brings us to the middle of the 20th century. And then in 1950, his son-in-law took over, and he's the Lubavitcher Rebbe, or just the Rebbe. who led Bur Chabad to what it is today. And one thing to say, actually, there's a special connection, I think, between the Rebbe, the last Rebbe, and the Rebbe Maharash. And that is, first of all, in the 1940s, the Rebbe was also a very prolific publisher. And he founded Kahas, the Chabad publishing house. And one of the big projects that he took on, he took on many different projects in those years. For example, we were talking before about Samach Sadek's Tshuvas. He was the one who brought them back into print in the 1940s and started working on different editions. He was a bibliographer. He was a scholar who compiled and created maftechas, indexes, and so on. And he also published the Rebbe Maharash's Sfarim. He was the first one to start publishing the Rebbe Maharash's Sfarim, except for one sefer, the Rebbe Maharash, which was published in 1884, which we'll get to, which was a whole controversy in itself. And he also published a compilation of stories about the Rebbe Maharash's life based on his father-in-law's talks and memoirs. But he put out the first biography of the Rebbe Maharash, the only biography, really, of the Rebbe Maharash, was actually compiled by the seventh Rebbe, the last Rebbe of Chabad. So there's a special connection there as well.
Okay, so now let's go back to the Maharash. Like I said, Shmuel Schneerson, and so when was he born, where they live? You know, just to give a brief overview before we go down and what your article discusses specifically.
Okay, so the Rebbe Maharash was the youngest son of the Samach Sadek. Some of the Samach Sadek's sons had already been born in the lifetime of the Alter Rebbe and had already been students of the Mittler Rebbe. So his brother Maril, who was the second oldest, was actually known to be a Talmud Muvok of the Mittler Rebbe. And he, the Maharash was about 30 years his junior. And he was born in 1834, base year. And in a way, he was seen actually as being quite different to the other brothers, partly because he was younger, partly because of his personality. He went into business in the lifetime of his father. It seems that he became independently wealthy. He had stocks. He invested in different business concerns. The different anecdotes about this, the government records about later on how he had, today it's kind of standard. We think of the Rebbes as, living a more kind of luxurious lifestyle than the rest of us. But in those days, it wasn't always the case. There were different modes, right? Some rebbes were more ascetic, and especially in Chabad, it wasn't the norm to have, like in Druzhin, let's say, which was a very machistic or kind of royal court. In Chabad, that wasn't really the way. But he, even as a young man, he was independently wealthy, like I said, and he had a house that was, that was built like one of the wealthy. There's like anecdotes that mentioned he had French windows, French doors, and things like this. So he had a different kind of personality, and I think that he himself didn't necessarily see himself as becoming a rabbi. It wasn't like the natural thing for him to be a rabbi. But something happened in the last years of the Samach Sadek's life, which it seems that the Samach Sadek was pushing him in that direction. It seems that he started to see Maamorim maybe about 6 months or 9 months before the Samach Sadek passed away. And we can get into that whole context when we talk about the controversy. And when he did become Rebbe, he was seen as, there were at that time several Chabad Rebbes, because several of his brothers also became Rebbes in different places. And I think he was seen as different. We have different memoir accounts and different documents where we get the impression that, I think it's Chaim Chernovitz, Rav Tzair, who says that the more conservative chassidim, the elders, were attracted to Maharil, the second son of the Samach Sadek, but the younger, the bolder, the ones maybe who are more open-minded, or wanted a more kind of contemporary mode of chassidus, they were attracted to the Maharaj. And he passed away in 1882, Yud Gimel Tishrei. And after he passed away, there was actually a period where there was a kind of a vacuum. None of his sons really stepped up right away to become rabbi. So that's a whole story in itself. But it took about 10 years before Rashab, who today everyone knows, Rashab, who was this massive architect of the yeshiva Tanchit Mimim, and he was an activist who, campaigned to reinstate the authority of the rabbinate in Tsarist Russia, and who was a tremendous intellectual powerhouse. His memorial very famous for the clarity and so on. But it actually took about 10 years before he fully kind of embraced the role of his father's successor, as his father's successor.
So you mentioned that the Tzemach Tzedek, and you alluded to Maril and all that. Maybe just who were the other sons, and what number was Marash? And then, I was going to ask you about he was much younger. Why did he become rabbi? But I guess leave that. So first, just explain why. Who were the other brothers, and where was he?
Okay, so like I mentioned, you have Maril. The oldest brother was Baruch Shalom, who is actually the direct ancestor of the Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe. He was a more retiring kind of personality, and kind of he's described as being humble, as shunning public attention and so on. Whereas Maril was clearly a very charismatic person, like a natural leader, in the kind of the old Chabad style. Like I said before, he was a student of the Mitra Rebbe, so he had this kind of legacy, this connection to Chabad of old. The Alter Rebbe was his son, that had his bris. So he had this pedigree and this connection, I don't know if I used the word in the article, but I called it once the nostalgia, the charisma of nostalgia. Right? There's a certain charisma that comes from this connection to the past. And I think that that's something that he had. And he's described also as being someone who davened with great passion and fire, and who said mamorim in a very hasbaradic way, explaining things very clearly and elaborately, perhaps in the style of the Mitra Rebbe. We don't have a lot of data on this. We don't have transcripts of his mamorim. Very little has survived, because he only passed away 6 months after his father. So there's a very short period in which he actually kind of was independently Rebbe, as it were, in his own right. So that's the two older sons. Then there are several more. There was Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, who was married into the Chernobyl dynasty and already became a Rebbe in the Chernobyl style in his father's lifetime. And there was Rabbi Chaim Shneur Zalman, who later became a Rebbe in Liadi. And there were a few others. I think by the time of the Tzemach Tzedek's passing, there were 6 surviving sons, but there were others who passed away in his lifetime when they were still very young. At least, I think, 2 others. So you started asking about why it was that Marash became Rebbe. And so this gets us to really the main topic, or one of the main topics of the article that I contributed to AJS, which is trying to figure out what exactly happened in the last years of the Tzemach Tzedek's life, and what led to what actually became a split in Chabad. So as I said, as I kind of alluded to, Maril did become Rebbe, but he didn't become Rebbe in Lubavitch, which was his father's seat, the Tzemach Tzedek's seat. He left Lubavitch and went to Kovost, where he served as Rebbe till his father had passed away, Yud Gimel Nissan, before Pesach. And he passed away sometime after Tishrei, maybe Hanukkah time, the following year. So just a little more than 6 months later. So there was one Tishrei in Kapus, which was like a big event for those who were close to him, and there were a lot. There were many important chassidim who went to Maril. And for example, the very important Chabad chronicler or historian, Chaim Meir Hillman, who wrote Beis Rebbe, which is even today, academic scholars still rely on Beis Rebbe as an authoritative source, an authoritative chronicle of Chabad up to his time, up to the end of the 19th century. He was from a family that was loyal to Kapust. And so there was the split, and it had to do with these two, I think, very different personalities. On the one hand, you have Maril, who, like I said, is the charisma of nostalgia. And then you have Marash, who's maybe the charisma of the future. You know, he's young, he's of the time. He's younger, more maybe intellectually inclined to them, those who are kind of more in tune with what's happening in the world around them, see him as the key, the person who has the boldness, who has the kind of savvy, the worldliness to take Chabad into the next generation, into the new Tukufa. And together with that, this isn't just about, you know, him being wealthy and him being a worldly person. It's also something to do with his intellectual approach to the tradition of Chabad thought. And that's what I get into in the second part of the article. I would say that there's basically three factors in the whole controversy and the split in the movement. One is that in the last years of the Sena Tzedek's life, he really took a backseat from the leadership. And he spent most of the time in his room. He didn't come out to the Chassidim except once a week on Shabbos to say the Maimer. And most people could not hear him. He would give out the Maimer already as a written transcript so that people could learn it. And he didn't even join the Chassidim for davening. The Chassidim would daven with the sons. Each of the sons already then had their own minyan. And they were already attracting their own loyalists, as it were, their own kind of sub-courts, satellite courts, in Lubavitch, already for about 5 years before the Sena Tzedek passed away. So there's a natural kind of fracturing happening just by that, by virtue of that alone. And I think, as I argue, I think that he hoped that this would continue after he passed away, that there would be a shared leadership that wouldn't necessarily be just one rabbi. And I make that argument based on manuscripts where we can kind of trace Setelach that he wrote, notes that he wrote, and I do a whole investigation of these manuscripts and how we can read them and how to make sense of them, which leads to the second point. The second factor in the split is that he didn't leave a clear will. His will was fragmented. He was, as the controversy was already developing in his lifetime, with different visions emerging about what should happen, he seems to have been responding to different people in different ways or at different times in different ways. And although he probably did write some kind of will, that too was a fragmented document. He wrote different pieces at different times. And so there was no one document that kind of said clearly what should happen. And so after he passed away, we have this whole competition and this whole fight going on over what he meant, what he wanted, with people drawing on different setelach, that things that he wrote, notes that he wrote, to back up their version of what should be. And the third element is the intellectual element, which is that, and this is what I really devote the latter part of the article to, is showing that Marash was really developing a new approach to Chabad thought, which centered much more on the continuity between God and the material world. So whereas previous Chabad thinkers tended to de-emphasize the importance of the world. Here I'm really oversimplifying quite a bit, but broadly speaking, we can say that if you read the Alter Rebbe's Mamorim, you could make the mistake that he thinks the world isn't real, or the material world isn't significant, and there's this, the academics use the term acosmism. There was a very big debate among scholars over whether the Alter Rebbe was an acosmist or wasn't an acosmist, did he believe the world is real or not? But when it comes to the Rebbe Marash, you can't make such a mistake, because he actually is arguing very forcefully and very explicitly that the world is real, that the world is not just real, but it's imbued with the full significance of God's own self, as it were. And there's a kind of ontological continuity. The being of God isn't beyond the world, outside of the world. Of course, it is beyond the world and outside of the world, but it's also in the world. It also permeates the world, which, again, in some ways, this is a very old Hasidic idea. But the way that he talks about it is with a new boldness and a greater degree of explicity, which I think would have rubbed more kind of conservative traditionalists to them the wrong way. They felt that this was not faithful to the spirit, as it were, of the old way of Chabad thought.
So that's a nice, like I said, overview of your article. And we'll get more, and let's go more a little bit through each part. You mentioned like offhand, but I think you said the Tzemach Tzedek will or lack thereof is fascinating. And you go through a few of these manuscripts, I think some new ones in the article, which are really interesting. Before we get back to the like intellectual part, what you were just saying. So first of all, you said how you explained how the Tzemach Tzedek kind of delegated the authority during his life, but just discuss a little bit the manuscripts that you looked at of the Tzedek, of his will. And then you also discuss the letter of Maril, a purported letter of Maril that Maril wrote. That's really fascinating. And so, you know, like you also mentioned, like the Tzemach Tzedek wanted some sort of horizontal shared power approach. So, yeah, discuss that part. And then we'll get, like I said, to this set, the latter part of the article.
Okay, so there's a scholar in Israel, Ilya Luria, who has written two books about Chabad. And he was the first one to analyze one of these manuscripts that I look at, which is, as Lurie points out, it's clearly written already in the 20th century by a Chabad Lubavitch loyalist. And it says, at the top of the manuscript, it says something like, Savos chak admar Tzemach Tzedek, you know, the will of the Tzemach Tzedek. But once you read it and you start analyzing what's going on, you see that it's really a compilation of what the term used is setelach, notes, right? Sometimes in chassidus, sometimes we use the term setelach as something that you would write, a note that you'd write to a rebbe. But here, these are notes that the rebbe himself wrote. As I said before, the Tzemach Tzedek had basically shot himself in his room for the last 5 years of his life. There's kind of some Kotzka vibes over here. You know, his wife had passed away by then, and he said, "Ein li etza. I don't have advice to give now that I don't have a wife." And Chassidim interpreted this as, in mystical terms, that the Rebbetzin is like Malchus, is the Matrinusa, which, you know, connects. The Rebbe is really beyond the world, and Malchus is the middle, the faculty that connects higher, that which is beyond the world, with the world. You know, so he was missing that link. The way that he communicated was mainly through setelach. People would write in a question, and he would write back an answer. And so what you have in these manuscripts is compilations of these setelach, which relate to the controversy, which relate to questions of who should be rebbe. And I would say the overall theme is that he seems to want the things to continue after he passed away as they have been during the last period of his life, where several of his sons have kind of stepped in to take on the role of Rebbe alongside each other in his place. And as I argue, I think Maril was seen as the most prominent of them, but there was a certain level of equality. And maybe towards the end, that balance started to become upset by Marash, who initially had not been saying Mamorim, had not been repeating his father's Mamorim and teaching his father's Mamorim like his other brothers, but now started doing so. That seems to have set a controversy in motion, and perhaps some of these setelach are responding to this. Some of them are addressed to Marash himself, encouraging him to continue saying chassidus, continue to offer advice to people, continue to teach, and so on. And some of them in very strong language, and even in language that kind of mirrors the language we find in Tanakh, where David and Shlomo, you know, the handing over of power, or we find with Moshe Rabbeinu, Chazak Be'amot, Moshe and Yeshua, you have this kind of language. So there are these kind of echoes of a handover, a succession, handing over from one Rebbe to the next. But again, none of these things are very clear, and there are competing setelach. I would say that most, but by looking at the different manuscripts, what I was able to see is, for example, two particular manuscripts have many of the same setelach, except for a few. Which ones are, some are only in one and missing from the other. And those are ones that critique Maharil and say that Maharil promised to treat Marash fairly, and he's not doing so, so I retract everything that I said in the past. Doesn't say what he said in the past, but he's retracting something, right? These are, and similarly also censuring or critiquing Maharil's son, Shlomo Zalman, who would later become Rebbe in Karpus in his father's place, who is a nephew of Marash, but older than Marash. So you can see why he might not have been so happy that suddenly Marash is, has this prominence. He kind of expected to be the Yerush through his father, who was for many years already had been a leader within Chabad. And suddenly his younger uncle is attracting a following and saying these mamorim that are kind of paving a new path in Chabad thought. So the question is, were these setelach fabricated by people who are loyal to Marash, who wanted to say that the Samach Tzedek retracted from whatever he promised Maharil, or are they actually authentic and they were omitted by other copyists who wanted to preserve the honor of Maharil, right? So, and I don't have an answer to this question. It's just a lot of things that I kind of leave open. But I think by looking at them, you can see that there was a debate going on. Even if we can't say who was right exactly, there was clearly something going on, right? That's the impression that comes out. Okay, and you mentioned Maharil's letter. So Maharil's letter has not been discussed at all in previous scholarship. It's mentioned in one article, but not discussed in any way that's relevant to this whole topic. It was really mentioned kind of tangentially as part of another polemic, really, which Yeshua Munshen got involved in, but we'll leave that aside. So this letter, first of all, I mentioned before Beis Rebbe. So this letter is mentioned in Beis Rebbe, but it doesn't say anything about the context. And I was able to, by comparing this letter to some passages in Beis Rebbe, I could see that Beis Rebbe was using this letter when he wrote his account of what happened when the Tzar passed away. He drew on this letter. So that tells me this is probably an authentic letter. And certainly the Karpus Chassidim thought it was authentic. The Beis Rebbe says he doesn't want to say too much about the controversy. He mentions it, he acknowledges there was a controversy. He doesn't go into details. He wants to preserve the honor of all the parties. And he says the mice of Satan, he says that there was this thing, and you can see in his account he's drawing on this letter. So what's important about this letter is, number one, it's written by Maharil from Lubavitch to a certain chassid called Reb Zalman of Kraslava, who's also mentioned the Beis Rebbe, and he's kind of consulting with him about what to do about the situation. And he feels very uncomfortable in Lubavitch. He says that the hotel proprietors in Lubavitch are showing setelach to all the chassidim who come, which are supporting Marash. And when he asked to see what they're copying, so there are already copies circulating, and he asked to see the original, and he says it was a forgery. And he says, I have my own setelach. So one thing about this letter is that you see already right after, as soon as Maharil arrives back in Lubavitch, he had been away, he had been in Kremenchug when he heard the news. As soon as he arrives back in Lubavitch, there's already this controversy going on, and there's already debates about which setelach are authentic. And he says, I have my own setelach, some of them are in the Samach Tzedek's own hand, where he says exactly the opposite. Again, he doesn't say what it says exactly, right? But there are many things that we can corroborate, right? By looking at this letter, we can say, okay, so there was satlach circulating. These weren't made up later, right? Like I said before, one of the manuscripts, the manuscript that Ogiluria wrote about, is from something like 40 years later it was copied. So you might think, oh, this was just made up then. But no, clearly, already at the time, these satlach were in circulation and they were preserved and copied in many different iterations. And there's a manuscript at JTS which has satlach. Some satlach already appeared in print, in the 1950s in various journals. Some of them have been published by Shalom Bar Levin, the Chabad librarian in Igros Kodesh of the Samach Tzedek. Some of them actually survive in the Samach Tzedek's own Ksav Yad. You know, so we have the original, you can see facsimiles published there by Bar Levin and also by Yishol Munshein. But the thing about Maril's letter is that it gives us a real-time window into what was going on. And just to finish up, what happened in the end was Maril is there considering in the letter whether he should leave Lubavitch. And that's what happens. He does leave Lubavitch and he sets up his own court in Kafist. And so that's the beginning of a split in Chabad where you have two parallel dynasties, which lasts until about the 1920s when Kafist comes to an end with the arrival of communism. And it's, I would say, actually, it's a miracle that the Chabad Lubavitch didn't come to an end during that period as well, which is a story in its own right. And then several other the Samach Tzedek sons later, Yosef Yitzchak, Yosef Yitzchak was already rabbi, and like I said, he married into the Chernobyl dynasty, so he was already functioning as a rabbi already in the lifetime of the Samach Tzedek. But others. Chaim Shneur Zalman became Rebbe in Liadi. Another one was in Nezhin, but that happened later. They, for a while, they actually stayed in Lubavitch with Marash as Rebbe, and they probably had their own Beis HaMedrash, but it was Marash who was the main Rebbe. And they were in some way subservient to him, which was exactly almost the opposite of what had been happening if you go back a year or two in the last years of the Samach Tzedek, where Marash was a private citizen living in Lubavitch, but not, you know, not saying mamorim, not fearing like a rabbi, not conducting himself as a rabbi. And Maril was the main figure in Lubavitch with the other brothers around him. Obviously, the Samach Tzedek was still there, but, you know, Marash clearly had a privileged position. It says in one testimony we see him, he was the one who would chazer the maimer before, after Kabbalah Shabbos on Friday night. So there was, throughout the week, the other brothers would repeat the maimer of the Samach Tzedek. But Maril would repeat it on Friday night. So there's a certain prestige that he had. And this was completely flipped around once the whole controversy unfolded.
So before we get to the Marash's style of Torah and his writing, but just one question. I mean, is this like unique? Because I think you mentioned the Mittler Rebbe with Samach Tzedek. I don't remember which one. One of them also wasn't the oldest son. I mean, is this something that's like, because it seems interesting that the Marash was so much younger than Maril, just in years-wise, age-wise. And then, like, he was number whatever, I don't remember what number brother he was, that he would become Rebbe. I mean, so was it, like I said, was it that Samach Tzedek wanted this, like, split of power, or somehow, some way, is it conceivable that, no, he actually thought to skip over all the other brothers and go all the way down to Marash to be the Rebbe? It just seems interesting.
Right. I mean, there's no way really to know. First of all, yes, there were always... this isn't the only example of, you know, a split or a controversy and so on. Already with the Mitzvah Rebbe and Rabbi Arnav Shashali, you have a split and a controversy. And then later on, the Rashab, like I mentioned, was the middle son of Marash, but it was he who became Rebbe and not his older brother, Azar. But to answer the question, I think it is possible, and I kind of present a scenario, a possible scenario in the article, that at the end of his life, the Samach Tzedek did indeed change his mind, as it were, and see Marash as the main perpetuator, the one who would continue his project, the one who would kind of follow in his footsteps, and maybe not just follow in his footsteps, but have the boldness, have the ability to branch out and develop what he had been doing further. And to explain that, though, I'd really need to begin to talk a little more about the style, his engagement with Chabad thought and with the text, the textual tradition that he inherited.
Perfect. Right. So let's go there. Like you said before, you gave an oversimplified, you know, explanation. I mean, you go a little bit more in depth. Obviously, we're not going to go super in depth here. It's in the article. People can read it if they want to, you know, to go really in depth. But just a little bit more to explain that. Like I said, his textual tradition, his style, the Marash's style of Torah, how he was getting, what he was doing. Was he innovative or not? Talk about that. That's the latter part of the article. And that, like you said, that's connected to what we were discussing.
Okay. So there are really two parts to this. One is methodological and one is theological. So what are the methodological? So like I mentioned before, we have in Chabad this really very rich tradition of the Rebbe's saying mamorim, these discourses that explain Kabbalistic concepts. And it's an ongoing, flowing conversation. Now, I also mentioned that the Tzemach Tzedek, in Lakote Torah especially, was taking the texts of the Alter Rebbe, taking the Mamorim of the Alter Rebbe, and contextualizing them and relating them to one another. But the way he did this was through these very cryptic, shorthand glosses, where he'd say like, a lot of ayins. It's almost like Rogachev style, ayin, you know? And very rarely does he say, sometimes he will say, b'zeh yuvon, and I'll say a few words of explanation, and how one text illuminates another or gives you a deeper understanding of another. And there's some amazing gems you'll find. Pshat and Tanya, Oymak HaPshat, the deeper Pshat and Tanya and things like this. But generally, he just tells you, he gives you a list of references. And you have to do the work yourself, if you're going to do the work, of figuring out what does this tell me? What's he contributing to the discussion here? So the main contribution that the Mitzvah Rebbe, that Tzemach Tzedek made was really curating and organizing, and then these kind of gestures. This mimer is related to this mimer, this mimer is related to this mimer. And there's also contextualization in terms of, you know, what's the Alter Rebbe innovating and so on, in terms of its relationship to earlier Kabbalah and so on, but all very brief. What changes with the Rebbe Marash is we see that he changes this into, from being a very brief, cryptic, let's say, note form kind of discourse, he is now doing it on a much larger, broader scale, and he develops what's known today as a hemshach. So he serializes mamorim. Instead of saying a mimer one Shabbos and another mimer the next Shabbos, which has no connection, it's just about the parasha of the week or whatever, a new topic. On the one hand, he is connecting it to something very local and topical, the parasha of the week or the Yom Tov or whatever it is. But at the same time, he's continuing the theme from the previous mimer. And part of what I try to show is that when you start looking at these hemshechim, I took one example, the Hemshech Fakacha, which was one of the longest that he did, one of the longest series. It started on Pesach in Tav Reish Lamed Zayin. It's 1877. And it finished about Hanukkah time the next year. So it went all through the summer, through Tishrei, till nearly Hanukkah time. I think it's something like 43 discourses, and they're all linked together. And what I showed is that actually he's following, he's taking a mimer of the Alter Rebbe, which was published by the Tzemach Tzedek in Lakote Torah, and he's almost following the stage directions that the Tzemach Tzedek put in his Haggahs, where he said, look at this mimer, look at this mimer, look at this mimer, and he's taking all those different concepts and showing you how they relate to each other, expanding them, but he isn't just repeating what it says in those mamorim. He's also advancing a new theological project. And to put it very simply, he's focusing on what is chachma, right? So chachma, we translate it as wisdom, but obviously in the world of Kabbalah, chachma can't just be translated as one word. and really you could give a whole series of classes on what exactly Chochmah means in Kabbalah and in Chabad. But he's making a new contribution. The way I would sum it up is that usually we think about Chochmah as within the realm of creation, as it were, within what's called Seder Hishtalshlus, the order of the cosmos. But it sees something beyond. It sees God as he is transcendent beyond the cosmos. That's Chochmah, Ri'iyah de Chochmah. It's this vision of something beyond. But it itself is still very much kind of the cosmos. But here in Bekacha, the Rebbe Marash is reconstructing our concept of Chochmah so that we now see Chochmah as something that is really beyond Hishtalshlus, something more like Keser, something which is more closely associated with Keser, with the infinite revelation of God that is beyond the cosmos, but it's kind of interjecting itself into the cosmos. So on the one hand, there's a certain continuity going over here between what is beyond the cosmos and what is in the cosmos. And this relates to what I was saying before about how, in general, not just in Vekacha, but again, another thing that I discussed at length in the article is a maimer that he said almost every year in different iterations, expanding it each time. But he already said it in the lifetime of his father. And I think this is part of the controversy that he said such a controversial maimer, where he argued for that you have to say that the world is real. And it's animated, not just animated by God, but it's kind of continuous with God. It's a projection of the divine, not that God is beyond the world and kind of creates the world, and that the way that God is revealed in the world is discontinuous with his transcendence. No, the transcendence of God is kind of beneath the very surface of our reality. And this is something that he sharpens and theorizes in more and more explicit ways, and reading it back into earlier Kabbalistic texts, going through synthesizing the Arizal with earlier forms of Kabbalah, with Ramak and going back to the Avodas HaKodesh of Rabbi Meir Begabai, going back further to Rabbeinu Ezriel, who was, you know, before the Ramban, one of the very early Kabbalists. And he's really making a synthesis that really further develops and underpins this kind of new way of thinking about reality, physical reality. So on both counts, both on kind of the methodological count of how he's kind of creating, weaving the text together, and also on the theological side, he's really very much his father's Talmud, right? In a very clear way, you see how there's this imprint, this influence of his father, but he's assimilated that and made it his own, and he's doing something new with it. And going back to the Setelah and the controversy, I think there are echoes of this in some of the Setelah, where you see Marash encouraging him to continue to teach and not to be afraid. You get the sense that there's an opposition to his way of teaching Chassidus. And you get the sense that this is perhaps why the Samar Tzedek actually sees him more than the other sons as the one who will continue. And we do have Bamara from other sons of the Samar Tzedek, especially from the Rebbe in Liadi, Chaim Shneur Zalman, and we also have from Shlomo Zalman of Kapust, the son of Marel, and you don't see this kind of new development in the same way—a whole new genre, or this close following of the Semasetic way and developing it in new ways. Of course, maybe more research can be done, and we can find new things there as well. The fact that you haven't yet seen what's innovative doesn't mean that there is nothing innovative. But just from what I've seen so far, there does seem to be something very unique about Marash's approach, which would then be further developed by his son, the Rashab.
Something that you mentioned about Marash earlier on in the podcast was how his writings were not really published till more relatively recently. You know, there was one thing that was published. So talk about his writings in general, and then why, what was the one thing that was published? Why was only that published? And why wasn't anything else published? When, you know, what happened there?
Right. So continuing this point about the continuity between the Samach Tzedek and the Maharash, we have a manuscript that existed in the Chabad library, which seems to be basically a blueprint for a sefer that Maharash himself was working on publishing. And it was, in fact, published after he passed away in 1884 by his sons, with the title Likutei Torah Legimel Parshiyos, or Likutei Torah Misefer Bereishis. And again, Likutei Torah was the title of the Samach Tzedek's compilation of the Alter Rebbe's Mamar. But the thing is that Likutei Torah is only on Vayikra, Bamidbar, Devarim, and Shir HaShirim. On Bereishis and Shemois, there's a separate sefer which was published earlier called Torah Eir, also by the Samach Tzedek, compiled by the Samach Tzedek, but it doesn't have the same degree of additions from the Samach Tzedek. So it has the Mamorim that the Alter Rebbe said. Very seldom, sometimes it does have some glosses, some haggos from the Samach Tzedek, but they're usually very brief. In Likutei Torah, you have a lot more material from the Samach Tzedek. Not only that, you also have additional biurim. So like I mentioned before, the Alter Rebbe would sometimes say additional biurim on the maima. So in Likutei Torah, you have a lot more material related to each maima. Whereas in Torah, sometimes there is an additional biur, but less frequently. So what it appears is that the Rebbe Maharash wanted to create a new Torah Eir according to the format of the Likutei Torah, meaning adding in additional biurim that existed in manuscript that had been transcribed already in the Alter Rebbe's lifetime but remained in manuscript and were not put in the Torah Eir, and also to have more haggos than the Samach Tzedek, because the Samach Tzedek spent his whole life writing haggos, many of which remained in manuscript until the 1940s and 1950s. As I said before, it was really the Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe, who really, he created Kahas, the Chabad publishing organization, and brought so many things that were previously only in manuscript into print so that everyone could have them on their shelves. But Maharash already had a vision to create a Likutei Torah on Bereishis and Shemois. And Likutei Torah Legimel Parshiyos was essentially that vision on the first three parshiyos, Bereishis, Noach, Lech Lecha. But in addition to the Samach Tzedek's Haggos that he put in, so he's including material from the Alter Rebbe, new material from the Alter Rebbe that hadn't previously been published, new material from the Samach Tzedek that hadn't previously been published, but also some of his own additional Haggos. And this is really what sparked the controversy, because on the Shablat, it said, I have to look at the exactly what the Lashon was, but I think there were actually two Shablats. On one of them it says, the Samach Tzedek's name, and one of them it says the Rebbe Maharash's name. Many true elaborations, discourses, and glosses have been added by the Admiral Rabbi Shmuel, son of the Admiral Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Lubavitch. So the Kopista Chassidim, and I would say probably not just the Kopista Chassidim, but actually we have correspondence showing that Rav Shlomo Zalman, the son of Maril himself, took umbrage, was upset about this publication. He took issue on intellectual grounds over the new Haggos from the Maharash himself, which again is connected to this whole theological innovation, this whole new direction that Maharash was taking Chabad thought in. And there's a correspondence between Rav Shlomo Zalman and the Chassid Don Tamarkin, who was the brother of Rav Yosef Tamarkin, the Rav Kremenchuk, who also has tshuva, the big Baal Halacha. But Don Tamarkin was a gevir, and he was also the head of Kollel Chabad. And he was somewhat of a mediator between Kopist and Lubavitch during this period. And he defended Maharash, and he corresponded with Shlomo Zalman about these issues. There's a I think in Beis Rebbe, when it mentions these letters, it says Devarim Ha'indim Barumi Shalala. You know, he had a correspondence with Rav Shlomo Zalman about things that stand at the highest peaks of the cosmos. So, but it also there was the, it wasn't just an intellectual debate. It was also about who is the true successor of the Samach Seder. By printing a volume which says the Kutei Torah, and it's not, which is the Samach Seder Sefer, and it's continuing the project of the Samach Seder, the Maharash and his sons, who published the volume after he had already passed away, are asserting that he is the true inheritor, the one who is continuing the Samach Seder's path. And obviously, Kappist did not like that at all. They saw that as an assumption, you know, they too were, and he, in one of his letters, he says, you know, we all have Ksavim of the Samach Seder. Who are you to go and decide that you're the Balabas, that you're the owner, that you have the publishing rights, and to put your name, the name of your father, the Marash, on the Sharblat? Right? So this was a big controversy. It's also linked to a controversy related to Kol Chabad and funds and so on. But you have this part that's directly related to Sfarim and to intellectual, ideological, theological debates.
And then, like I said, the rest of the of his writings only were published much later.
Yeah, so it was the seventh rabbi before he became rabbi in the 1940s. Once he came to America, he started publishing these under the title Lakutei Torah, Torah Shmos. So again, you have that continuity of Lakutei Torah. But at the same time, on the one hand, he used that title, which is clearly a reference to the Kutei Torah of Gemara Parshas. On the other hand, he never republished the Kutei Torah of Gemara Parshas. And when he did republish the material that was published in the Kutei Torah of Gemara Parshas, he included it in Eir HaTorah, which is the series of the Samach Seder's writings. So he didn't want to draw attention to this machlekas. So there is a kind of residue of it, a hint at it, in that title, the Kutei Torah, but it was kind of, they didn't want to make a big deal about it. They didn't want to draw additional attention to it. He did speak about it a couple of times, and there were Chabad traditions about what exactly happened, whether the Kappist Chassidim might have actually interfered in the original publication of the Kutei Torah of Gemara Parshas and maybe put things that weren't supposed to be in there. It's a little murky. If we compare the manuscript, there are two or three things in the manuscript that are different to the published version, but for the most part, it's the same. Right? But so you do have these later traditions about something being done by the Kappist Chassidim to interfere, right? Which may be the case. We don't have any contemporary evidence to indicate one way or another. But one additional thing to say about kind of the history of the legacy of the Rebbe Maharash is that not only did the seventh Rebbe print his material, but I think that he had a certain affinity to the Rebbe Maharash in style. The one thing I didn't mention about the Maharash style is that he is very succinct and bold and sharp in his formulations. I didn't really discuss this in the article very much either, but whereas if you compare to Rashab kind of explains everything very at length. Maharash doesn't explain things at length. He just kind of throws out these bold statements and he writes in a very concise, tight way. And you see that in the seventh Rebbe's own writing, if you look at his Rishimus, and also in the edited versions of his Mamorim, they're written with this very tight, concise way. And the innovations are it's very easy to kind of see what's new because he's building the argument so tightly that when you get to the Vayesh Leimar, you know, you see this and there's something new here. There's something, a new contribution, which hasn't been made before. So, not only was he involved in publishing them, but I think that he was in a certain way a student. Of course, he was a student of all the previous Chabad rabbis, but there's a certain special affinity to the Maharash.
Okay, so something that I forgot to ask you earlier, but I think it fits well still here, is why did you decide to focus in your article? Why did you decide to write on the Marash specifically here now rather versus the compared to the other Rebbes?
Right. So in a way, this is a spin-up of a larger project. I wanted to really do an overview of Chabad intellectual history in general. But I knew that if I would start with the Alter Rebbe, there's so much material, I would never finish. Right. And there's already so much scholarship, so just to wade through everything that's already been done, and build on that, it's a whole, you know, I felt that I would end up just writing a book on the Alter Rebbe. So the Rebbe Marash, on the other hand, is completely under researched. There's no one study devoted to him. Certainly, not even an article. Never mind a book, right? And he tends to be overlooked. He's like the middle child. There's three rabbis who came before him, three rabbis who came after him. And even in Chabad, he's not really learned. People have his farm on the shelves, but very few actually sit down and learn through a Hemshech of the Rebbe Marash. Actually, recently, I think they put out like a compilation, Kahas, and there's an organization in Eretz Yisrael called Torat Chabad B'nei HaYeshivot. So they published a kind of compilation of Mamorim on different rabbis. They have one on the Rebbe Marash as well, with like classic selections, right? But in general, he's overlooked. And part of it plays into, especially in academic circles, a general assumption that in the 19th century, there's nothing really of interest in Chabad. And we were kind of discussing this before we started recording, that there's also, it might be part of a broader phenomenon of kind of an academic attitude to what they think of as Haredi Judaism, which they really see as starting in the 19th century. So before Haredi Judaism, Gedolei Yisrael are interesting. But once they start wearing black hats, it's like, oh, this is boring, right? And so they there's a certain assumption that there's nothing new. Early Hasidism was vibrant, is interesting, but 19th century Hasidism, The assumption is that there's nothing worth analyzing or researching. And so even scholars who have mentioned the Rebbe Marash generally really did not do their homework and tended just to kind of fall back on the assumption that he could not have been very impressive. So I realized, once I started looking at the material, learning through a Hemshech, I realized that it's so rich and there's so much to do here, and it really is a break with the past. You know, in a sense, like I mentioned before, the Mitra Rebbe and the Samosad, the Tamidim of the Alter Rebbe, and there's a very clear continuity between what the Alter Rebbe was teaching and what they were saying, what they were writing. They each have different approaches to it, but broadly speaking, they're both Tamidim of the Alter Rebbe. The Rebbe Marash, however, is completely of the 19th century. He's born after his father is already Rebbe. And he's paving a new path. So it's actually here that you see some real innovation. One other thing I'll mention is, I mentioned this in the article in part, that this was a time of, that also in the wider world, there was an intellectual change that was underway. Eliyahu Stern wrote a book called Jewish Materialism, where he kind of traced how in the 1870s, which is exactly the period of Marash, Jewish thinkers, including Chabad thinkers, one of the figures that he talks about is a guy called Joseph Sosnitz, who came out of a very Chabad background, was a Talmud of the Samach Tzedek in some way, you know, went to Lubavitch, traveled to Lubavitch, and then he's reading all this stuff, you know, Darwin, and German philosophers who are, you know, there's a whole change from idealism to materialism. And he's trying to square it. In his writings, Eliyahu Stern shows that he's kind of grappling with how can he synthesize this with Chabad material that he learns. And he discusses explicitly, you know, the Samach Tzedek, Mamorim, and so on. And he, in his memoir, he wrote an article, a memoristic article. Later on, he came to America. And I don't remember where it is, but there's a book of kind of rabbis in America, a Yiddish book, where he has a kind of autobiographical article. And he talks about how he visited different Chabad rabbis after Samuel Tzedek passed away, including Marash, to ask them questions, philosophical questions. And he says, I didn't really get a satisfactory answer. But actually, what's really interesting is the Maharash was aware of this intellectual turn. We have a memoir account of someone who grew up in Lubavitch in the time of the Maharash, who says that he was reading the Hebrew science journals of Svi Rabinovich, or Rabinowitz, who is another figure that Stern discusses in his book, who was, you know, a pioneer in kind of translating contemporary scientific material into Hebrew and publishing it for, you know, a traditional Jewish audience in the Russian Empire. And we know even from internal Chabad sources that we have traditions that the Maharash read medical texts. There's a tradition that he was able to read Latin. Maybe, I don't know if that means Latin script or actual Latin. You know, maybe he was able to read German, you know. He was able to speak different languages. And so he had an awareness of these intellectual developments. And I think there's a strong argument that can be made that this turn away from a cosmism, or away from what I call the rhetoric of a cosmism, and towards a kind of, again, the term that I use is apotheosis of physicality, imbuing physicality with real significance, with divine significance, that kind of reflects this broader trend. How explicitly he had that in mind, was he responding to it? I don't know. But it's certainly in sync with kind of the spirit of the times.
So, fascinating. Is there... So first of all, about your article, is it accessible anyway that for anyone to read or without having AJS? Is it an academia? Is there any way anyone can?
It is on my academia page, so where it's free for everyone to access. If you go on Twitter, I put a link to it up there at some point or another, so you could probably find it there.
Okay, I'll try to link to your academia page. You mentioned that there's really nothing, but I mean, is there anything, if anyone wants to read anything else, the Maharash, is there any other reading to read on him or not? Not really.
So on the Maharash, there's nothing really, besides for, you know, the few sources which I mentioned in my article, but really it's really just a few lines here, a few lines there. For Chabad more generally, there are certainly many good books that I could recommend. Most recently, is Halil Lowenthal's Hasidism Beyond Modernity, which is it's a very good book, which gives a kind of a general overview of Chabad intellectual history. It's really a collection of his articles that he wrote over many years, but with some new material and linked together to kind of present a broad overview. And you see certain themes that begin to emerge in a very clear way. And then, of course, there's Ada Rathbort, Albert, and her, she recently put out a book, Hasidic Studies, History and Gender. That was her last publication. Also collected articles, but thematically linked. It's really a statement of her research, mostly on Chabad. There's other, she deals with Breslov as well, but really a large focus on Chabad over many years. And both of those are published by Lippmann Library. So those are the two, my two go-to books, if you want a good overview of Chabad thought and Chabad history and its development over time.
Okay. Very good. Very interesting. So thank you, Eli, once again for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.